Well, hello, everyone. Welcome to Tech Can't Save Us. We are excited to have Dr. Julia Barbareski, Disability Innovation Researcher, currently working with the Keio School of Media and Design. Julia, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
And you're coming all the way from Yokohama, Japan. You're our first guest from Japan. So thank you for doing this during your supper time.
Thank you so much. No, it's great. I moved over here in November. So I'm really recently relocated in Japan. And yeah, it's about, what is it? Like 6:15 p.m. So not too bad anyway.
Well, let's jump in, as we do with all new episodes in this this new season two of Tech Can't Save Us. We're going to jump right into the headlines. So one of the first ones that we shared, and obviously, given the focus of today's conversation, we're going to lean towards headlines that deal with the area of research that you're involved with, Julia. So one that came up that I know touches on both a passion of Will's and a passion of yours is gaming and accessibility in the disability innovation space. So you shared with us this piece from TechCrunch about how accessibility in gaming is both a challenge and opportunity. So we'd love to just hear what both of y'all thought about that piece.
Yeah, I've been absolutely. That is a piece that I particularly like to read recently because it touches on several things that are important. One is that a lot of the tech that is around for people with disabilities is very functional and not so much about fun. Whereas in the last few years, companies have been making a lot of strides into sort of making gaming more accessible because, games and play before was used to be considered something that, children do and adults don't, dedicate time to it. But that tide is really changed. And I think it's very important. I mean, the groundbreaking was probably like the Xbox Adaptive Controller, which just, it's a really cool interface that makes sort of the traditional gaming controller a bit more accessible to people that have different level of dexterity. And the thing that I like is that it's very inclusive. So, you can play equally well whether you do or don't have a disability. The other thing that I really like is when it comes to, representation in gaming and disability, there begins to crop up. There's still not enough, but some really cool characters with disabilities that pop up in game here and there that really do give a true portrayal that is not sort of just, the bad guy or overcoming disability, which is the usual narrative that is done over and over again. They're just people that do cool stuff and they happen to have a disability, which is, what happens in real life.
I do think as well there's it's kind of part of a wider trend we're seeing where a lot of just tech is starting to think, okay, cool, so we do X. We've proven we can do X really well. How do we now make this more accessible? We were chatting a little bit about it before. One of our clients, Hopin, is going all in on accessibility for events and in conferences. And we've seen in the event space, previously massive event organizers that would put on like hundreds of physical events without ever really giving a thought about disability as anything other than a kind of a bit of a sort of like, let's make sure we're ticking some boxes exercise, is now really, really opening up the event space for folk with disabilities, because virtual really does make it a lot more accessible. And parcel of that is they're starting to make the tech much more accessible in terms of, simple things like closed captioning for people with hard of hearing. But more and more, Hopin is and other folk in that space are really thinking how they can make sure that speakers, attendees, sponsors can be from any walk of life and with any level of ability. It's just an objectively good thing. And one of, this podcast focuses quite often on a lot of tech for bad, but I think it is objectively tech for good that we can all get behind. And I do like what one of the speakers at one of their events recently was sort of the head of accessibility of one of the major tech companies, and they have cerebral palsy, and they're just couldn't really go on the speaker circuit up until the pandemic hit. And because of the pandemic and the acceleration towards virtual and now hybrid, you know, that head of accessibility can speak at a conference every day, whereas before they'd maybe be lucky to get to one a month that had put the actual effort in to make sure everything was accessible, understood the unique specifications for the speaker podium and stuff that they needed, and just, you know, was willing to put the time and effort in. So it's a great trend, and it doesn't surprise for me to see it in the gaming community, which can often be horrible, but sometimes has a bit of a heart of gold. You know, Comic-Con has a long history of being about 10, 20 years ahead of companies in terms of like making itself accessible as an event for folk with disabilities. And I go to Comic-Con quite a lot. And, you know, like there are a huge amount of kids in wheelchairs and like who, and every security guard, every single store owner knows exactly, like, you know, like, hey, my son has Asperger's, and they just immediately know what that kid needs to feel comfortable and to enjoy the experience. So it doesn't surprise me to be seeing it in that community, because I think it's been there for a while and now the tech is catching up.
And I mean, imagine all the troubles that we could have saved if we would have thought about accessibility from the beginning rather than always adding it like afterwards. And also, like, all the, I mean, you made the example of you know, the speaker like at the conference. Imagine all the talent that we lose for, you know, not having places accessible when it comes to work. But also, like, as businesses, all the customers, like users that you potentially lose by not being sort of inclusive, not putting a hat that says, you know, maybe actually not everyone is the same. And we keep talking about minorities when it comes to people with disabilities, but approximately 15% of people in the world have some form of disability. And, you know, where age increase is just going to get bigger. So it's not that small of a minority, you know, that argument doesn't really stand.
Yeah, I'm always astounded by these, like, some of the stats in this piece, obviously, like, you know, there's in the UK, at least, there's 14 million, you know, disabled people, you know, with billions in disposable income, and sort of like the missed market opportunity. And it's a shame. We need market opportunities to kind of lift the veil and, you know, get us interested in, to your point, Julia, you know, doing what we should have done in the first place, which is, you know, just providing space for them in the context of gaming and all other spaces. But I am fascinated by the different, you know, before this call, we talked a bit about, you know, universal design for learning from the education space, which is the space that I come from. And just the power of designing, you know, experiences, be they gaming, be they learning experiences, from the start, with an eye towards folks who are differently abled. And I thought some of the things they mentioned here in this piece about, you know, accommodations for colorblindness, you know, slowing down gameplay, more granular difficulty options, you know, for various, you know, skill levels. That to me just seems like makes the game more interesting and more in depth in a way, because you can sort of play with those different options and optimize the game for your experience. So that just jumped out to me as like, I'd love to, you know, change how the colors appear and change, you know, how fast the game goes.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there is a lot of things that are sort of sold as accessibility options that in reality, they just make life better for everyone.
And to your point as well, are embarrassingly easy to do. You know, like, it's like, you know, some stuff designing around disability is takes a lot of real thought and effort, but, you know, slowing down the speed of a game, everything is already there to do it. It's like, it's a couple of hours of code. Like, it really isn't that much more. So yeah, like you said, Julia, you know, sad that it's come retroactively and retrospectively even, and how much better would it be if we designed from the start. But it, you know, I think a lot of industries and tech is realizing like, oh, actually, yeah, this isn't that hard. Like, making this, like, for the most common disabilities, making this accessible for hearing impaired or people with visual impairments really doesn't take that much more money or effort from us. And, you know, and unfortunately, like Paul said, it's probably normally driven from a monetary perspective rather than a moral perspective, but still, I can get behind it, those ends justifying those means if that's the what we get is better tech that's more accessible.
Relatedly, want to throw out another large number from one of the other pieces that we read for this is another area that folks with disabilities are underserved is the area of sex toys, apparently. And one of the fascinating figures from this piece on Medium was nearly 1 billion disabled people worldwide are currently ignored by the growing sex tech category. The article goes on to say it's leaving them frustrated, searching for solutions, and just 1% of this market would represent billions of dollars in untapped revenue. So, Julia, you shared this piece with us. We'd love to hear. I mean, the name is fantastic. Like, tell us about Bumpin'. I think there's a joystick involved. Like, what? tell us more about Bumpin' if you can.
Yeah, absolutely. I've been one of the things that I particularly love about companies like Bumpin' and their other companies that have started to make inclusive sex toys as well, is that they suddenly bring focus to something that has been neglected for decades, which is people with disabilities are almost always portrayed in a way that it infantilizes them. Whether they have sort of visible or invisible disabilities, that you know, their disability might be associated with a mobility impairment rather than a visual or a cognitive one, it doesn't matter. We always portray them in a way that it's sort of infantilized or sometimes as a tragic outlook. And one of the interesting thing is that even when you look at sort of, you know, campaigning and research and stuff, a lot of it focuses on public aspects of life. Things about like education, employment, voting rights, transportation, you know, all things that have to do with the public sphere of life. And one of my favorite quotes, I hope I'm not going to butcher it, but comes from Tom Shakespeare, which is a remarkable disabled scholar that is based in the UK. And in one of his pieces around sort of disability and sexuality, it says that some of it, it's a matter of priorities, or has been sold as a matter of priorities, because, you know, like campaigning for access to school or employment, it's more important than campaigning for access to pubs or for a good fuck. And this is in the paper, my favorite line on a paper ever, which is true, but it's also as he highlights throughout his research, is because that has been an area of such a level of exclusion and sort of pain and shame for so many people with disability for so long, that even sort of a lot of activists wouldn't have touched it sort of so much. And it's great to see that is coming up so prominently, because sex and sexuality are hugely important aspects of many people, not necessarily for everyone, and it has different relevance for everyone, but it's just part of that personal aspects of life that has to do not just with sex per se, but also, you know, relationship and you know, connection and things like that. And I find that companies like Bumpin', which of course is spearheaded by a person with disabilities, because, you know, they tend to know the problem inside out and be a lot of time more bold in their innovation, which is exactly what we need. And yeah, there's basically a remote, because that you can use to control a sex toy that doesn't need hands to be operated. It's sort of, you know, like very big, it's cushioned, so you can use your arm, you can use different parts of your bodies to control it. And it's just, you can be comfortable. You can be comfortable that, you know, you're not hurting yourself. You can be comfortable and relaxed, because, I mean, imagine trying to use a sort of, you know, sex-related technology in a situation where you're really tense, you're afraid to hurt yourself, you have to be really careful. like, you know, where is the fun in that? and it's great to see like these kind of company that brings it, these ideas forward and bring inclusion to all aspects of life, because it should be in all aspects of life.
Yeah, something we spoke about with Chris from Sifted on the last pod was just, and this is a point Paul made, so I'm quoting Paul on a podcast, so fully stealing your ideas and quoting them back to you, which I thought was really fascinating, which I hadn't seen, is like this: the first wave of big tech problems solved were all big tech problems that white 25-year-old men have who live on the East Coast of America, because that's who designed tech. And as we've start to see representation, suddenly you see folk creating stuff that just no one would have thought of, because yeah, of course you're never going to think of designing sex toys for the disabled market unless you're disabled, because you're going to be thinking, how do I get my Uber quicker, how do I get, you know, those are the tech problems that are top of your mind. And so as you see, you know, I know it's not headline news or an insight, as representation happens, society gets better in any, whatever form it is. And like, this is almost the 20 years on, as people have fought those fights to make sure that people with disabilities have access to boardrooms and companies and funding, you see awesome stuff and unexpected stuff like Bumpin. It just works. Representation works, and we should be doing even more to fucking make sure it happens.
Yeah, 100%.
Want to move us forward a little bit here and get into the meat of it, as it were. Would love to just hear, obviously you've walked us through, you know, various headlines, things here. Would love to just hear how you got into, disability innovation research, and, you know, where you got your passion for it from.
I am a physical therapist by training. I trained in Italy. I graduated about like a bit more than a decade ago now. Much more than a decade ago. I'm sorry. Yeah. I always delude myself about my age, but basically, that's where I got sort of my initial interest around disability. I was used to work in a spinal cord injury center. I worked in a rehabilitation center for people sort of post surgical or post acute care, of different sorts. Certain point of my life, completely on a random whim, I have to admit, I moved to Ireland. And when I was in Ireland, I study medical device design. So I was very interested in the tech part of stuff. And I have to say, when I was working in a spinal cord injury center, I had like a fetish for wheelchairs. Like I love assistive technologies. I know that they're like associated with a lot of stigma, which to me it's absolutely nonsensical, because they're tools for freedom, and I just really wanted to bring them together somehow, this passion for technology and my sort of understanding of disability and previous physio training. So I applied for a doctorate program at UCL around accessibility and assistive tech, and I moved to London in, I believe it was 2014, and started from there.
I love folks like origin stories, so I like to dig into those a bit. Would love to hear, like, what did you learn about disability, you know, as a physical therapist, and kind of, yeah, what did you learn about yourself? Like, what, you know, I want to get into that seed of kind of how it grew into you becoming a disability innovation researcher there.
I probably, the biggest thing that I learned that I bring with me a lot in my work. So I spoke about assistive technology being tools for freedom. But they're tools. They don't solve problems without certain skills. Like, you know, if my sink breaks and you give me, like, you know, the tools that a plumber have, that doesn't mean I'll be able to fix my sink. They require a lot of skills to be used to the maximum sort of advantage. And that's one thing that, like, get grossly overlooked when it comes to assistive technology. Like, people think that pushing a wheelchair around, it's easy. It's not really easy. Not like driving a wheelchair with a joystick, it's not easy. You know, it's not just a physical effort. I still remember when at the start of my PhD for like an experiment of a colleague that was working on motion control. It was an undergrad student. He was testing different interfaces that you use to drive the chair. And I had a decent amount of experience with things like joystick and head arrays. So basically switches that you have around your head and you press them in a way that then sort of guides your wheelchair. And I did reasonably well on those. But one of the interfaces was like a sip and puff switch. So in a sip and puff switch, you drive a wheelchair by, you know, blowing air into it or sucking air from it. And you give commands, and then by continue sort of puffing or sipping, you make it turn. I crushed in the wall so hard that the foot plate got stuck in it. So because I panicked as I was approaching the wall and started like hyperventilating. And I mean, and people think that driving a wheelchair is easy. It's not. Using a screen reader requires a lot of skills. And all the skills that people develop get grossly overlooked. We always focus on how amazing the technology is, but the reality is that the people that use them are, and people with disabilities have a huge amount of creativity, largely forced onto them. By the fact that they constantly have to deal with a world and a society that puts them at disadvantage. So they consistently have to find workarounds. And that, yeah, leads to huge creativity. I think, again, my favorite sort of Tom Shakespeare author calls that adversity inoculation, which isn't necessarily a good thing or something that we should advocate for. Because it happens in a lot of situations, we should acknowledge that it actually allows people to develop some amazing skills.
I thought of you the other day. I'm going to give away a little bit about myself here. I was at a party. I was at a rave, and there was an individual there who was in a wheelchair. And I was starting to think up questions for this conversation, things like that. But then I also started to think about some of the artistic technologies that you've been interviewing folks and working on yourself, and just thinking of, you know, how could we sort of optimize the experience for this individual to potentially create more of a dancing sort of motion centric experience, and should we? So it's just kind of like a fascinating sort of self thought I had to myself as I was dancing and thinking about this individual. But would love to hear more about your recent area of focus in terms of artistic technologies in the disability area.
Yeah, my artistic technologies project right now, I have to admit, it's one of the most fun I've had working on sort of a project before. Like I'm truly enjoying it. And 90% of it is because I get to chat with really cool folks. The idea was initially born from watching like a dancing performance of wheelchair dancers. There is an inclusive dance troupe called Kinetic Light. They're based in the States. And they had this really cool show where they had sort of all ramps built around the stage, and the dancers were doing like amazing choreographies. And I was watching it and thinking, you know what? Couldn't do that if you had two standing dancers. You know, they could do other things, but they couldn't do this choreography, right? So I started to like trace back a little bit, and basically the idea behind it is that as we were saying before, a lot of the technologies that you have right now are developed with this idea of sort of let's bridge a gap, right? But we need to bridge gaps because we live in an accessible environment, you know, like there are man-made barriers that then we try to create man-made solutions around. But when it comes to art, you can forget about that for a second. And just looking at people with disabilities and sort of like the skills that they have, the way that they move, the experiential value that they bring into their art leads them to create art that it's different. Not that there isn't this paradigm of better or worse. There is just different. And actually, what it becomes is not even different. It becomes unique. So one of the things that I've been chatting, I've been really lucky to interact with artists that include sort of dancer, performance artist, circus artist, visual artist like painter, both sort of, you know, traditional or digital artist, musicians and sculptors. And it's like, you know, the question, do you think that being a person with disability has changed your art for the better? And the answer most of the time is yes. Some of them were artists before, some of them became artists. And the project in itself focuses on wheelchairs in particular, because I'm very lucky that this is a fellowship project, so I could design everything myself, and why not go for my original fetish of wheelchairs? And seeing how people integrate their own chairs into their own art and what creative possibilities that unlocks, and see what other things sort of could be unlocked. So I talked to dancers about the choreography that they create now and what other movements, you know, or creative possibilities that they would like to explore. Because when we detach ourselves from the constraints of the real outside world, we can start to explore different movement patterns, you know, different creative possibilities that are not chained down by the feature of an inaccessible environment. And I think art goes a long way to help to push this ideas that, you know, there is no better, no worse, there is different, and there is unique. And I think that's extremely powerful.
Any artists or dancers you can recommend for us? And what's kind of the coolest work you've seen from that space, from you, the work you're doing?
For privacy reasons, I cannot, of course, give names of people that have taken part. But there are some like artists that I love in the UK. I mean, one visual artist that is a very good friend of mine, he actually illustrated the cover of the book that I recently wrote with a colleague. And his name is Jason Wilshire Mills. He's is a disabled artist. He's based in the north of England. And like, he's a digital artist, he's a visual artist. And his art is incredible. It's this combination of pop culture from like Britain in the 70s, is about campaigning, is about sort of grief, is about representation, and it's about fun. Like, a lot of his art is very playful, and Jason is a true technologist. He leverages anything from 3D printing to augmented reality to creating sort of digital video games realities, and now he has huge inflatable sculptures that travel around the UK. He has one that I love that is about accessible toilet, and it tells sort of the experience of inclusion through this art that it sits inside this giant inflatable sculpture where you enter through his butt. But it's extremely evocative and powerful.
Well, obviously, I want to give you a chance to shout out the book, Disability Innovation. Julia, you mentioned it briefly in your last response, but yeah, tell us a bit how it came about and what its focus is.
So this is a book that I didn't write by myself. I wrote it with my colleague and an incredibly good friend, Professor Catherine Holloway, who in 2014 was kind enough to undertake the supervision of my PhD. Throughout the process, we also became very good friends. We continued to work together afterwards. And we joke that that book has been probably in the making since we met each other and started to work together, because the work that I do and the work that Kathy does sits across different spaces. And when you work between sort of the space of disability and technology and health, before we were working in transport, accessibility, one of the things that you spend a lot of time doing is explaining to each other why one discipline is important, right? And in that book, we try to bring together some of the views that have to do with, you know, the power of technology and innovation and what cool things should be and could be done. But a lot of the tech innovations that there is around HCI looks at, you know, very small scale or early prototypes. And as academics, sometimes we're not that concerned about getting actually things in the hand of people and making sure that we work in larger systems, because, you know, like a lot of assistive technology gets distributed to health and welfare program, or it has to integrate in education. And in those cases, you talk about sort of very big national and international systems that have to be brought together if we want to truly develop, you know, like deliver impact.
One things we wanted to discuss with you is just language around, you know, talking about disability. I think there's, you know, just a lot of different conversation about how to refer to folks. I know coming out of the education world, you know, we talk about learning variation, and there's been a shift towards, you know, this idea of like differently abled people and trying to kind of soften the language. But would love to just hear your perspective on that. And because I know that a lot of our listeners probably feel as if they just don't know what to say, or as if they're walking on eggshells about kind of how to refer to specific disabilities, individuals with disabilities. So we'd love to just hear your perspective on it.
This is a ridiculously difficult question. The reason for it is that there is no right or wrong answer, right? So even in terms of using persons with disabilities or people with disabilities versus disabled people, both can be good. And sort of some people prefer identity first language because, especially, for example, in the UK, that would be the norm, because the disability rights movement will say that a person's disability shapes, you know, it, so much of one's identity, it's contextual and it's up to the person's preference. So I have no straight answer there. I assume that the best advice that I can give is I usually ask. So I ask someone in the same way that you would ask someone these days, hopefully, if, you know, they have preferred pronouns that they like to use. You can always ask someone how they prefer to be addressed. I would say that's probably the best piece of advice that I can give. If I use a particular language, so in a lot of my work, because it's targeted at international audience, I sometimes stick with using persons with disabilities because that's the UN language, that's the one most commonly used. But usually I say why I'm using certain language, and if I change it, and sometimes I want to use sort of more politicized statement, especially when I'm making very strong case about sort of the social aspects of exclusion. In those cases, I would use disabled people. It's a very convoluted answer. I'm sorry.
No, not at all. An important one. Yeah, I think it's getting rid of that taboo where people feel like they need to walk into the conversation knowing exactly how to refer to people, where it's just like ask, you know, just say, hey, you know, yeah, what pronouns would you like to use? And, you know, is there anything you'd prefer and how we reference? I think it's just people being afraid to talk about stuff. That's the thing that needs to change more than anything. In addition to, you know, yeah, whatever language a person's comfortable with.
Want to move us into the kind of lightning round that we typically do with all guests. We shared some of these questions in advance, so hopefully they're not too much of a surprise. We'd love to just hear it, and specifically interested in this question for you in terms of the tech stack that you work with and game-changing products, and be curious to hear from sort of a disability innovations angle what you've seen out there. It can be something you maybe don't personally use, but yeah, just what's interesting to you now.
In terms of tech stack that I use, I don't have a computer science or an engineering background, so I tend to be a tech opportunist. So I use what is sort of might be useful to the particular application or problem that I'm working on. So I learned to become sort of a jack of all trades. And it can be anything from, I'm a huge fan of things like microcontroller and like, you know, Arduinos and Raspberry Pis to do sort of easy prototypes to, I mean, I used software for design sometimes, things like Blender if I have to do sort of illustration and things like that, or some of the Autodesk products. The tech that has changed my life and probably everyone's life in the last 2 years, I would say sort of video conferencing. It's a very simple answer, but I mean, think about what I was thinking about, what I was saying before in terms of communicating with artists and things like that. I've interviewed for my current project like about 20 artists from different domains. That were based in UK, Australia, US, India, Japan, but I think that has been sort of a game changer, the ability to do things remotely.
Yeah, people forget how bad video conferencing was before the pandemic. Like, you know, even the everyone went to Zoom, but everyone forgets how terrible Zoom was right at the start of the pandemic. Is yeah, 10 years of innovation in like a year and a half has gone into just that specific tech product.
Julia, what's one problem that tech can't solve for us, and why?
I would say none. largely because, you know, that as I was saying earlier, tech is a tool. We can use tech to solve problems. I mean, you know, we can use video conferencing to sort of, you know, make remote education a possibility, but it's not going to be enough. So I would say tech is not going to be enough to solve any problem on its own, but we can leverage it to solve problems.
Cool. Our favorite question in lightning round, tech for bad. What's the evilest application of tech that you've seen out there?
Don't think there is something that it's universally evil. I know you want me to say sort of social media and Facebook, but I've seen it used for good as well. You know, like, I mean, social media has been used to create, like, I've seen it in some of my recent work, sort of support group for education and things like that. And that's brilliant. I would say there is one sort of tech that I really don't like, and I don't see any good reason for it. I would say probably Bitcoin and NFTs. And when you have sort of financial services that are not transparent, and an NFT, you have no idea of, like, people are buying things that don't exist yet. We don't know what we're buying and selling. It's that for me, it's tech for bad.
That's interesting, because a lot of people, of like a lot of people in the generally, you know, left space get quite excited by the potential of decentralized currencies and AFTs?
There is potential for it, but I mean, you know, look at A, who has made money out of it. You know, it's about jumping on the wagon earlier. It's those environments in which sort of, you know, you can't have negativity because you're buying trust, but that it creates a sort of the level of toxic positivity that is possibly more dangerous, because, you know, questioning then become devaluing the product. And I'm always very skeptical of environments where you can't ask questions.
I have a friend who has made quite a lot of money from crypto, and he's like, they're just legalized Ponzi schemes. And what people never talk about with Ponzi schemes is the first 5% of the people who get in on the Ponzi scheme make a lot of money. And like, the whole art of crypto is making sure you're in that first 5%. Basically, everyone else gets the rug pulled from underneath them. And it is just it's a pyramid scheme. Like, it's a total pyramid scheme.
And I, general sort of has, ideologically, I don't like pyramid schemes or things that are like concepts that are sold on the fact that, you know, my luck has to be your bad, you know, that it has to be between you and me, and I have to become a millionaire and you have to be a miserable one. Just never my cup of tea.
I think we can all agree that pyramid schemes are bad. You heard it here first.
We love a good, no, love a good hot take on tech and savers. Thank you for your, that's I think we'll have to do an episode on crypto at some point, Julia. So thank you for leading us into that. Be fair, even though Facebook is the correct answer for that question, we just want you to be yourself. That's all we want from Tech Can't Save Us. So you can answer with any.
And, you know, and we said this before in our last class. Yeah. Social media can be used for good. It absolutely can. And has, very much has been. It's just, you know, if you create a community wherein people can enjoy support while also undermining the fundamental tenets of democracy, it's a net bad.
Scale is tilted. Well, on the more positive side of things, and again, super curious to hear your answer for this question specifically. If you could dream up a new tech product, what would it be, and what problem would it solve, and for whom?
I don't know. The thing is that it's probably one of the most complicated answers ever. I don't know what the product would be like, but I suppose a system to democratize and increase access to education. That is what it would be. I believe that education is the source of all our problems and the root of all our solutions. And we aren't going to go very far from it. So, Paul, you'll be very happy as sort of an ex-educator. But definitely, yes. And I'm not talking about education just in the sense of knowledge. I mean it in terms of, you know, like possibility for exchange and growth. Education, it's really not about skills. Skills are important, but they're definitely not the most important thing.
Yeah, that one really resonates, because I think during you know, the height of the lockdown restrictions and things like that around the world, like, there was definitely a part of me that was, my heart was really breaking for a lot of educators. You know, I had a friend in the States who was like a, you know, a mom of a 7-year-old and also a middle school teacher, and was just struggling with, you know, this remote learning thing and, you know, scale that across millions of teachers around the world. But then I think there was also a slightly like sadistic part of me that was like, yeah, this system really needs to be disruptive. And like, you know, the kind of, we need to like figure out a different way to educate and have a better experience for learners and for teachers. So, yeah.
Absolutely. And I think tech can help there. Actually, some of the work that I did in the last year with the Global Disability Innovation Hub and with the World Bank as well, was around sort of looking at the impact that edtech had in sort of low income countries, because one of the things that we have as well is that, you know, we think about education going remote in the UK or the US, but what about Uganda or Kenya or, you know, Bangladesh or Nepal? And there has been sort of effort and there has been work there, but especially when it comes to inclusion, it's been really tricky. And part of it is that, as we were saying before, it boils down to inequality. You know, if you're a person with disability, your family is more likely to be poor, you're less likely to have access to tech. When everything moves remote, you know, that's, you're the one who suffers the most for it. So yeah, I would say, like, if I could solve one problem in the world, I would say democratizing access to good quality education for everyone.
So Julia, what's worked well for you in terms of building a career in tech, or that's tech adjacent, that balances profit and purpose?
Every time I listen to this question on the podcast, I always find it hilarious. Because as an academic researcher, I don't think I've ever had that problem in terms of like having to balance sort of like profit with purpose. I mean, most of the time, I would say that like profit doesn't really drive me. Like it's just I like to interact with cool people. I would say probably the dichotomy for me is between sort of like productivity and purpose. So the difference between sort of doing something that I like and I care about, even if maybe, you know, I can't write a paper on it, because that's how you translate those academic coins, if you want.
Yeah, and just to give you a bit of a shout out, I mean, as someone, I spent first 28 years of my life in education and kind of, you know, and a good chunk of that in the academy. And it's just really cool for me to see someone like yourself who's, maybe, I don't know if you think of yourself this way, but sort of like an applied researcher. So someone who gets out there and, you know, you represent your research in a number of different ways, be it the podcast, the book, you know, applied stuff that you're doing with the artistic technologies and things like that. And it's, and I'm sure on top of maybe teaching and research, you know, sort of inside the academy as well. So it's just cool to see that multimodal approach to just your own learning and sharing what you're learning and researching. So thank you for that. One final question for you. We'd just love to hear about a prediction that you have for the coming year in the tech/tech for good space. We can wrap up there.
I would say that the predictions that I have are actually around employment and education. I think there has been a lot of movement, especially when it comes to inclusion. I mean, nobody can claim anymore that what we're going to be what was used to be denied before when it came to reasonable adjustment for work and inclusion that was deemed to be non-reasonable, that excuse doesn't hold anymore now. And I think it's a huge area where sort of technology will have to be retaught in terms of how it enters the space, but also how it doesn't create just a different level of this, of exclusion.
That answer really resonates with us because we look at, you know, we've seen, I think, probably the most energy from, you know, our clients in the HR, you know, human resources tech space. And whether you look at, you know, Athena, US-based company that's using tech to make sure that, you know, training for preventing sexual harassment in the workplace is really robust and engaging. Look at Progression, UK-based, and how they're building, you know, learning and development into career pathways for employees, or even Oyster, that's, you know, democratizing how companies can scale globally and incorporate workers, you know, around the world in a, you know, safe and holistic way. I think there's just like a ton of opportunity there. And I think oftentimes HR tech doesn't get seen as tech for good, but I think it really is like what makes your life, you know, better than go, you know, where you spend 40 hours a week almost and you feel really valued, you feel really included. And I think we touched on that earlier in the episode as well. So it's a good, good point to wrap up on there.
Yeah. I was going to say everything can be solved for, in education and employment. I think like once those two are sorted, then yeah, society just gets much better.
Absolutely. Well, this has been a fantastic conversation, Julia Barbareski, disability innovation researcher. We really appreciate your time coming all the way from Japan and cutting into your dinner time. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been an absolute pleasure, and I just had really good fun.
And if folk are looking to find out more about your work or maybe even buy your book, Julia, where would they be able to do that?
I would say they can find out most of things about me on my website. It's Julia, spelled G-I-U-L-I-A, hyphen B-A-R-B-A-R-E-S-C-H-I.com. That's my personal website, and they can find information about myself, about the book, the artistic technologies research project, everything. It's going to be there.
It's a very comprehensive website. We're grateful for you sharing it. And we'll make sure we include those links in the episode description as well. So cool. Well, thank you so much for your time, Julia. Yeah, thank you
so much.